Welcome to Rishoko Seikai International of North America. This episode is a recording of the Lotus Sutra lecture given on December 13, 2020 with Dominic Scarangelo. Dr. Scarangelo is a PhD specializing in early modern and modern Japanese religions. He has taught at the University of Virginia and was the postdoctoral scholar in Japanese Buddhism at the Center of Japanese Studies, University of California, Berkeley. Currently, he is an international advisor to Rishoko Seikai.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I have a PowerPoint presentation to go along with my talk. My talk today is entitled, What is the Original Buddha? Discovering a Compassionate and Meaningful Universe Through the Focus of Devotion. So this talk was loosely based upon my article in the autumn 2019 issue of Dharma World. And that article was entitled, Given the Gift of Life and Sustained by the Buddha. Maybe later on, I'll use Zoom's chat function to distribute a copy of the article if you haven't had a chance to read it. There are some areas that the article goes into more detail than I will today. So today, what I'll do is I'll summarize a few main points from that article, and then I'll add some things that I didn't put in the article, and I'll go in a little bit of a different direction. And my point is to today is to add some ideas and some perspectives that I hope will be useful for your practice and maybe even for dissemination as well. So I wrote that article because I had been asked many times by members to clarify some of the words and phrases that Rishoko Seikai uses to describe the eternal original Buddha. In Japanese, you hear this phrase, uchū no daisēmei. Which can be variously translated as the great life of the universe, or sometimes it's better translated as the great life force of the universe. Members who asked me about this phrase often confided to me that this way of talking about the eternal original Buddha sounded more to them like it sounded like Hinduism, one person said to me. And a couple of people asked me, you know, this kind of language is it Buddhist? You know, people seem to be confused. Other people commented to me that this idea of, you know, the Buddha as the life force of the universe, or talking about the Buddha as giving us the gift of life and sustaining us, seemed to be making the Buddha into a type of God. So these are the kind of questions and comments I heard. And it's the reason why I wrote the article to deal with those kind of issues. So the members that asked me these questions found this language, the great life of the universe, or given the gift of life and sustained, very confusing. So they asked, basically the questions or the queries behind their questions were things like, isn't Buddhism supposed to be non-theistic? Doesn't Buddhism say that the Buddha was not a god? Doesn't the Buddhism say that the Buddha did not create the universe? In other words, the Buddha is not a creator deity like God in the Christian or Judaic or Islamic tradition. A few people commented to me, I've never heard other Buddhist groups talk about the Buddha this way. And then a few people I've over time have said to me, well, this language sounds un-Buddhist. So I should mention that some of these comments came from committed Rishoko Seikai members, not, you know, people that have just maybe visited the Dharma Center for the first time. So these questions that members have had alerted me that there was something, I guess you could say, lost in translation. Now, this issue of translation is one of the hardest things in the world to do. Words, metaphors, symbolism in one language or culture often don't have equivalents in other languages and cultures. Or the meanings ascribed to a symbol or a metaphor in one culture can have a radically different meaning in another culture. This is why if you try to use translation software to translate between two radically different languages, like let's say English and Japanese or English and Chinese, what you get on the other end of the translation software is often laughable and sometimes even offensive. I don't know if you've ever tried Google Translate, but these are the type of strange things that you get out the other end. The challenges in translation are especially difficult in the case of spirituality and religion. And this difficulty is not limited to just language. The spiritual and ritual disciplines of a religion can be just as difficult to introduce to people of other cultures. Now, in my article, I mentioned this quote from Dr. Luis Gomez. So Luis Gomez says that Westerners tend to emphasize the critical and ascetic elements of Buddhism, imagining Buddhism to be a demythologized system of beliefs and practices. And Westerners do this perhaps because these aspects of the Buddhist tradition resonate with the modern agnosticism. Demythologized is a sort of big word, but what it really means is questioning the sort of mythologies and the legends of a system of belief and debunking them, or trying to see, you know, not seeing them as, you know, historical fact, but maybe representing some kind of other symbolic meaning. Also, many people in the West over the last two centuries became disillusioned with what they saw as a kind of unbelievable or unscientific stories in Western religions. And many people lost patience with what they saw as the refusal of Western religious traditions to adapt to changing times. These kind of criticisms have led people around the world to seek out alternative forms of spirituality that they think are more appropriate to the present age and their own needs. Such people often seek rational or philosophical spiritualities or religious practices that are in tune with science, the insights of psychology, and contemporary social practices and ways of life. People also seek forms of spirituality which are non-theistic, which is to say, spiritualities that do not teach the existence of or the need to believe in some human-like, God-like persona who rules over the universe, or personal gods that interfere and manipulate people's lives. There is actually a long tradition of hostility to what is called anthropomorphism. There's a long history of hostility, actually, in Western philosophy and religion to this type of idea. Now, anthropomorphism means the personifying things, seeing them as like people or persona. So, of course, in Christianity and Judaism, God is often described as human-like or as a persona. For example, calling God our Father, or representing God or Jesus in art or with icons. Sometimes you've seen, you know, in art, God the Father is this sort of gray-haired, bearded man, you know, up in the sky. And that's the kind of the image that has been critiqued, even within Judaism and Christianity at times. So anthropomorphism has been in tension with the notion that God is completely transcendent and fundamentally beyond our language and our complete understanding. So the religious criticism of anthropomorphism says that thinking of God as being like us with human characteristics, we frail and faulty human beings, thinking about God that way limits God, and thus it's an affront to God. The portrayal of God as a person using icons, of course, was also attacked as a form of idolatry. And this type of, the rhetoric of idolatry is especially strong in Judaism and Islam. In modern times, Western philosophy and the social sciences also reacted against anthropomorphism because they saw anthropomorphic religiosity as something childish or primitive. They saw it as a spirituality belonging to an earlier time in the evolution of human beings and society. Western philosophy and the social sciences also questioned something called animism. They questioned animism in religion. Now, animism, as I'm using it, means animating things. In other words, seeing things or processes as alive or like living things, possessing intentions, emotions, and purposes and agendas. So even in Western philosophy and the social sciences, anthropomorphism and animism have been very highly critiqued in the last couple of centuries. Now, with the rise of science and the increasing discovery and description of natural laws that govern the universe, and especially following the impact of scientists like Sir Isaac Newton in the 17th century, people began to look at the laws of nature as akin to God, because those laws ordered the universe. People also saw these laws as the workings of a God who may have given rise to the universe, but afterwards has been neutral and uninvolved in creation. This kind of thinking can be seen in some varieties of religious thought that appeared since the 17th century, such as a philosophy called deism. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard that word before, but deism was a sort of religious philosophy that many of the founding fathers of the American Republic subscribed to. Deism generally sees God as the cause of the universe and the cause of natural laws that govern the universe, but after creation, this God steps into the background and lets human beings discover natural laws through their reason and manage their own affairs and the affairs of the planet. So this is sort of the religious background, the philosophical background that we today have when we look at religion and think about religion. But add to this the discovery of Buddhism. In the 19th century, as colonial empires of European countries spread into South and East Asia, more and more Westerners came into contact with the cultures in those areas, and more people discovered Buddhism. Particularly, they discovered or became interested in Buddhism's philosophical writings. Many of these people thought that Buddhism's philosophy was a philosophy that didn't have a mythology, that got rid of mythology, and they saw Buddhist philosophy as a kind of agnostic or non-theistic way of thinking, and the truths taught in Buddhist philosophy sounded to them like the rational natural laws of science. Later, Westerners also became curious about some of the practical spiritual disciplines in Buddhism that could be understood as a type of therapy or science of the mind. And here I'm talking about meditation and mindfulness. At the very same time Westerners were discovering Buddhism, Buddhism was discovering the West. So South Asian and East Asian Buddhist thinkers, they had contact with Western science and philosophy, and this motivated them to undertake a kind of reformation of Buddhism. Now, this happened in Theravada Buddhism, especially during the 19th century, and in Japanese Buddhism, it started to occur in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, what came out of this was a kind of updated Buddhism. We could think of it as a kind of Buddhism 2.0, so to speak. Scholars call it Buddhist modernism. And it's a Buddhism that was in dialogue with the West and with Western thought. And this was particularly the type of Buddhism, this kind of reformed Buddhism that Westerners were attracted to. And it was what they often studied and brought back to Europe and the Americas. And then Westerners would often go further and they would strip out whatever remained in this Buddhism of its ritual, mythological, or magical practices. And coming up to today, or recent years, we see the rise of something called secular or agnostic Buddhism in the West. Indigenous Buddhist teachers in the West have been forging this sort of what we can think of as a secular agnostic Buddhism. They understand Buddhism as a kind of science of the mind and focus on the practice of mindfulness meditation. Now, these teachers often are uninterested in, or they attempt to strip away what they see as the ritual and mythological or magical elements of the Buddhist tradition. For example, it's kind of rare to find a Western Buddhist teacher practicing ancestor appreciation or invoking the name of the Buddha Amitabha. Invoking the name of the Buddha Amitabha and ancestor appreciation are probably two of the most widespread practices in lay Buddhism throughout East Asia, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam as well, and of course, China. But you rarely see those practices in what people refer to as Western convert Buddhism. Now, some of the well-known people I'll put into this camp of agnostic or secular Buddhism are some people you've probably heard of or read. For example, the neurologist and social critic Sam Harris. His podcast is very popular. Sometimes he is listed among the group of social critics known as the New Atheists. And another one I would put in this category is Richard Batchelor. He's very famous for this type of approach. And then there's social critic and podcaster Robin Wright, who is the author of the bestseller Why Buddhism is True. And I suspect that probably some of you have read that. And then I would also throw in there Dan Harris, who, if you remember, used to be a presenter on NBC News, World News Tonight. And he wrote a book called 10% Happier about meditation, essentially. The American and European Buddhist world is kind of awash in meditation teachers or gurus who are quite innovative and take Buddhism further and further in the direction of becoming a Western or American Buddhism. But I should point out that their Buddhism oftentimes looks and sounds quite different from the Buddhism that you see on the ground, quote unquote, in South Asia or East Asia. Now, certainly, if Americans and Europeans are going to practice Buddhism, Buddhism must be adapted to its new geographic and cultural home. Buddhism, you know, is going to have to be taught, spoken about, and grasped not only in the languages of the Americas and Europe, in the case of North America, English and Spanish primarily, but also in the metaphors, in the idioms, the symbolism, and through the cultural concepts, philosophical constructs, and the ethics of our own cultures. Inevitably, Buddhism must be adapted with an eye to the religious heritages of the West as well, because those religious heritages have been so influential in influencing our language and our way of seeing things. And what I would say is, to give an example of what we kind of have to do, I think you can see on the screen here, there's three photographs of food. Now, those of you who are Japanese will know that this is a type of dish called omuraisu. And what this is a Japanese adaption of the Western omelet. My first experience with omuraisu was when a friend said to me, let's go get Western food, a Japanese friend. And so I said, yeah, let's do that. So we went out to a restaurant and he said, let's have the omelets. And I looked at these and I said, it's not exactly the omelet that I expected. And we were also eating these omelets for dinner, not breakfast. Omuraisu is actually quite delicious, but as you can see, basically the basic recipe is it's an omelet stuffed with rice fried or cooked in ketchup, of all things. So what this is, of course, my friend thought, he said, this is Western food. You should appreciate it. Don't you miss Western food? But I said, this is not quite the omelet. This is not quite your grandmother's omelet, right? But what this is an example of is how one culture adapts something into its own culture, and the omelet has been adapted into Japanese cuisine and Japanese understandings of what Western cuisine is. And this is sort of what happens to cultural and religious practices and ideas when they get adopted. They come out the other side a little different, not quite the same. And if they don't, if they're not adapted to the sort of natural environment in their new home, they don't survive in most cases. However, Western assumptions about Buddhism and people's ideas about what is Buddhist in the West also presents many challenges. The adoption of Buddhism in the West is, as I said, it's a kind of a negotiation. As translators of Buddhism, the people who are looking to bring Buddhism to the West and disseminate, I think that those adopting forms of Buddhism to their own communities in the Americas and Europe are going to have to be rooted on both sides of the equation. I think they need to be familiar with the histories and pasts of their Buddhist traditions in Asia. But they also need to know the cultures where they would like to have Buddhism put down new roots. Now, the stereotypes and assumptions that people may have about Buddhism can be obstacles to this process of adaptation. Buddhist traditions and practices that don't meet with our assumptions or stereotypes may be seen as strange, confusing, or even illegitimate. Unfortunate assumptions or stereotypes may make people less willing to consider forms of Buddhism and Buddhist practice that do not square with their assumptions. Liberating practices may be dismissed at first glance, or the inability to understand or embrace powerful forms of skillful means may hinder people's liberation from suffering. All of this limits the spread of the Dharma and the reach of Buddhism's power to liberate people in the world. Now, when it comes to the challenges of overcoming these assumptions, these kind of assumptions that people have about Buddhism, the Lotus Sutra tradition is one such type of Buddhism that often struggles against such challenges. Lotus Sutra-based traditions of Buddhism, including Nishoko Sekai, don't always conform to Americans' images of what Buddhism is or what they think Buddhism should be. However, forms of Buddhism based in the Lotus Sutra, including Nishoko Sekai, offer practices and teachings that have great power to transform people's lives and to liberate them from suffering, expand their hearts and minds, and transform the way they experience the world for the better. So to deepen your own practice and assist your efforts at dissemination, I think it's important to be able to understand, explain, and embrace notions of the Dharma or the Buddha as the great life force that gives us the gift of life. And that's basically our task for today. So here are some of the themes that I'd like to go in and consider based on this background I've just talked about, this introduction on what we often think about Buddhism and how we came to think that way. So here are some of the questions for us specifically. Who or what is the eternal original Buddha? How can we make sense of notions like being the gift of life and being given the gift of life and sustained, or the phrase great life of the universe? How can we do this in a way that deepens our practice and aids in dissemination? How can we embrace these ways of looking at the Dharma and the Buddha in order to lead ourselves and help lead others to awakening? So keep this in your mind. These are the questions that we're dealing with today. So in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha reveals the universal truth essentially in two ways. In the first half of the sutra, which emphasizes wisdom, the Buddha declares universal truth as the 10 suchnesses. Now, this is, of course, chapter 2 I'm talking about. And then in the second half of the sutra, universal truth is revealed as the eternal original Buddha, and specifically chapter 16. Now, the 10 suchnesses is the ultimate reality of all things, or in Japanese, shohojiso. It's how all things manifest in our world, how they behave, how they interact with other things, and how everything changes. This teaching or law of the 10 suchnesses shows that different aspects of everything, the different aspects of a thing, one thing, are all interrelated. It also reveals how all things are, on the one hand, individual and unique, but at the same time, they're as if one, equal, interconnected, to the extent that all things create one another, such that we can say that even all things can be found within each other. The 10 suchnesses can be thought of as a kind of natural law. It's a very sort of logical, sort of almost scientific explanation of reality. And that's what makes it a little bit difficult, right? So the law of the 10 suchnesses permeates everything. And for this reason, all phenomena everywhere are an expression of the 10 suchnesses. And despite each thing being individual and distinct, every single thing is part of an ever-changing, always moving and transforming totality of existence. So Founder Nirino in his writings often calls this sort of totality of existence as a great harmony. In the verse portion of chapter 2 that corresponds to the 10 suchnesses, we see an explanation in somewhat enigmatic or difficult language that this teaching dwells in its inherent Dharma position, and thus all worldly attributes eternally abide. This description of the omnipresent universal truth is found in sutras throughout Buddhism, including those read by many types of Mahayana as well as Theravada Buddhists. Sutras written in, it can be found in sutras written in Pali, Sanskrit, and Chinese. Thus, this is not something unique to the Lotus Sutra, but a statement of Shakyamuni Buddha that all types of Buddhism can receive and embrace. In more readily understood language, dwelling in its inherent Dharma position means that the universal truth is fixed, and worldly attributes eternally abide means that this truth, universal truth, and by extension, the universe that manifests because of the workings of truth is always stable. This law operates in the same way in the world forever. And because of the workings of this law, there is always a universe. And this universe always follows this law. So it is here that we can grasp, maybe begin to grasp the notion that universal truth facilitates the arising development and transformation of all things in the world. In more neutral sounding and rational, sort of demystified language, we might say that we ourselves and all other phenomena manifest in this world, abide, change, and then transform to something else, ceaselessly and into the infinite future, in accord with this universal law. For those of you who are more inclined to an abstract, philosophical, or analytical, or maybe scientific way of looking at things, I think this is how you can translate a lot of the RK language into your own words. This is also how you can explain universal truth to people who are more analytically minded. And this maybe can help in your dissemination. Now, Founder Niwano of Risho Kosekai described the universal truth, essentially the 10 suchnesses, in the following way. Because it is the truth that permeates the entire universe and everything within it, the Dharma transcends the distinction of inside and outside. Even our own bodies are formed in accord with this truth and sustained by it. Our minds, as well, arise through this truth and function in accord with it. All things in society, the heavens, earth, plants, birds, animals, come into existence and live in dependence upon this truth. So that's how Founder Niwano describes universal truth in many of his writings. So the RK language, the Risho Kosekai language or discourse of being given the gift of life and sustained, is, from what I was saying before, a kind of animism. Now, animism, as I explained, means to animate something by seeing human-like intentions and actions in something. In this case, universal truth or universal law. It is a way, animism or animating, is a way of using positive, affirmative, metaphorical language to understand truth. As I said in my introduction, this type of positive language or metaphorical animating or personifying of truth has often been criticized in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, as well as in modern philosophy. So that's the cultural background that we have. But I think there are good reasons to do this. And I have, you know, I have friends that are very sort of hostile to this sort of animating or personifying truth in this way, you know, looking at it as a sort of great life force. And people, they instantly sort of have a reaction against that. But I think there are good reasons to use the kind of metaphorical language and use that as a guide to how to grasp and think about and make sense of universal truth. There are good reasons for this. Let me go through them. One very good reason is that because animating or personifying and even anthropomorphizing things is how human beings naturally perceive and make sense of the world. Developmental psychology and cognitive science have often portrayed this way of cognizing the world as primitive or childlike. But recently, some theorists now go against that thought. They counter it. And they assert that animating and personifying and anthropomorphizing is actually very pervasive in our thinking, in our speech. And that in some ways, we are even predisposed or wired to look at the world in this way. In other words, this is how we naturally think. It's not something primitive. It's not something that belongs to the dawn of the human species, but it's really how we go about our daily lives and how we make sense of the world. Let's take a look at some examples of this. Think about this phrase, or this, we would call it in English, a kind of idiomatic collocation, two words that often come together as an idiom. Angry skies, right? You might see this in literature, right? So you look at the sky. People would describe the sky in many ways as angry or threatening, right? Now, step back for a second. Is the sky really angry at me? From a scientific perspective, the condition of the sky is the result from falling atmospheric or barometric pressure, maybe the approach of a weather front or even a hurricane. And it's accompanied by these thick, dark clouds, right? However, if I say the word to you, if I say the words angry skies to you, you instantly understand what I intend to express. And you probably have an image in your mind, in your mind's eye, of the kind of sky I'm talking about. Or perhaps, maybe even your body begins to shake with the anticipation of fear. If you've ever lived through a really bad hurricane, it's kind of scary. And you will sort of go back and re-experience that feeling possibly. Or perhaps when I say angry skies, you can almost feel the wind of the storm coming and hitting your face, or the cold, hard, driving rain of the approaching storm pelting your body. So this is what animating or personifying in language and thought can do. What it does is it takes something that may be complex and that has lots of sides to it, and it compacts it into a smaller and a more efficient package. And it takes this complex thing or idea or phenomena, all different sides of it, and it turns it into a symbol or an image or a word that allows us in our minds to absorb all of those elements of meaning or even feel the meaning with our bodies. So that's just one example of animating or personifying. And here's another example, and this is kind of flippant, and if I can get this going here. I really love this. I really love these videos. I watch them all the time, and it's a form of therapy.
What are you doing? I need to put the bedding on. I need to put the sheet on, Key. Key, bye.
So here we have an interaction between a dog and a human being. And
get off that bed.
What this owner has done, of course, is. She has added the language that she kind of in her mind assumes or fantasizes that the dog is speaking back to her. We do this all the time. Talk to our cats and dogs, right? Why do we do that? Are we confused? Do we think our cats and dogs actually speak English or Spanish? Or Chinese or Japanese? No, we're not confused in that way. But yet we can step into this mindset of interacting with our animals in this way. And we make them more real to us. We make them more human. And it facilitates the relationship with them. Now, if someone talks to their dog, like this lady that is always putting up these husky videos, do we put them inside some kind of mental health facility? Of course not. They're not crazy. This is a way of interacting and perceiving the world. They step into and they step out. And we do this all the time. It's the way our minds work. It's the way we make sense and communicate with the world. So let's go on to a more serious sort of example or consideration. Let's think about taking refuge. The primary practice of all Buddhists is to take refuge. So we take refuge in the three treasures, right? One of which is the Dharma, right? The middle of the three treasures is the Dharma, right? The second one. And this, you know, means, of course, universal truth, or by extension, the teachings that lead us to universal truth. So taking refuge means to, in a lot of explanations you find in Japanese Buddhism, taking refuge means to go to something, to return to something, and to depend on it, to consign ourselves to it, to trust it with our lives. So this is what we call faith. Faith is often thought of these days as a kind of belief in the existence of something, or sometimes faith is thought of as agreeing to some kind of idea or proposition. But in reality, I think a better understanding of faith is that faith is really a relationship with something. We often have faith in people or the words of a person. Now, for those of you that are Japanese or Chinese, the character for faith, it consists of two components. One is the left hand of the character means person, and the right hand means words. Faith is the words of a person. It's part of a relationship. So we might have faith in a person or people and their words because we trust them. So in this kind of way, faith is basically a social relationship. And a relationship entails emotions. A relationship is between persons. So I think that developing faith in a teaching or universal truth and interacting with that, going to it and taking refuge in it, really can be aided, or maybe even requires that we animate, that we personify and even anthropomorphize the truth. If we're going to take refuge in universal truth, what do we look at? Which direction do we place our palms together in? We need a focal point. And that's what animating or personifying universal truth does to us. It allows us to have a relationship. We need to step into that way of interacting with universal truth, and then we can truly, really take refuge. So speaking and thinking about universal truth with positive affirmative language that animates or personifies it, the kind of language that Nichiren Kosekai uses, allows us to compress all the aspects and notions of universal truth into a more easily conceived notion that still contains all of its different aspects. But it allows us to have a relationship with it, to trust truth, to depend on it. And for this reason, the metaphorical language that RK uses to talk about universal truth, I think, shows a deep familiarity with the way the human psyche works. RK's language is a powerful, skillful means, I think, for deepening faith in the Dharma. Now, Nichiren Kosekai's language is not really taken out of thin air. It's really inspired by the Lotus Sutra itself. Take, for example, this passage from chapter 23 of the Lotus Sutra. And this is a section of the chapter where there are a series of metaphors or similes that are given to describe the Lotus Sutra. And of course, when we talk about the Lotus Sutra, we're talking about essentially universal truth. The Buddha says, moreover, just as great Brahma, heavenly king, is father to all living beings, so this sutra, read truth, is like a father to all wise sages, to those trained and still in training, and to those who aspire to bodhisattva. Now, in early Indian religions, Brahma, the god Brahma, was thought to have been a creator deity, the deity that creates people in the world. In other words, in early Indian religions, Brahma is the god that gives the gift of life to human beings. So the Buddha is making a metaphor, a simile, the truth, this universal truth, this wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra is like Brahma giving the gift of life and sustaining living beings. So you see that the RK language is very much inspired by the sutra. So the sutra itself animates and personifies universal truth. Now, does seeing the Dharma as giving us the gift of life and sustaining us mean that we will be unable to understand the Dharma and explain it in a more analytical or philosophical way? I don't think so. I don't think there's a problem there. We can see the Dharma from multiple perspectives as the need requires. Let me give you an example of how we can step in and out of different types of perception. Take a look at this drawing. Is this a rabbit or is it a duck? Can you see? So look at it right now, and can you see it as a rabbit? Okay. Now, can you see it as a duck? So you know now that you can see it as both, right? But you can switch your perceptions to sometimes see it as a duck and to sometimes see it as a rabbit. Now, our perception of ultimate reality of all things, universal truth, is the same, essentially. We can think of it in very abstract philosophical terms when we need to. And we can also think of it as something that gives us the gift of life and sustains us. Now, for example, we might want to think of the ultimate reality of all things, the 10 substances, as a kind of natural law or law of causation when we're looking at the events in our life, when we're trying to find out the causation, how things happen, why they happen, what kind of state of mind I was in that caused a certain event or phenomena to occur. And it's the application of the 10 substances as a kind of law of causation is one of the ways that we apply the Four Noble Truths to looking at our lives and our suffering. And in those times, we take a very analytical or sort of rational, almost scientific view of eternal truth. But when we take refuge, when we want to have faith in that truth, we can step into the animating, the personifying language of that truth is what animates us and gives us the gift of life. Both perspectives, we can use them, and both perspectives, I would say, are true and valid. Now, in the second half of the sutra, which is the teaching of compassion, the Lotus Sutra expresses universal truth in a different way. It uses the anthropomorphic metaphor of the eternal original Buddha to convey that not only is ultimate truth everywhere, but it has always been everywhere because it transcends time. The message of the sutra is that even though Siddhartha Gautama, the human being who discovered universal truth and became Buddha, is no longer with us, Buddha as a phenomenon, is ultimately the universal truth. And this truth as Buddha, as we can think of it, has always been in the world, is still in the world, everywhere, and always will be. And not just this, but chapter 16 also teaches that this universal truth is always reaching out to us through all phenomena. It's reaching out to us through all people and experiences in our lives. The sutra portrays an animated universe, one driven by the purpose of leading all people to become Buddhists. But the difference with the first half of the sutra is that here in the second half, especially chapter 16, the explanation is strongly anthropomorphic. It anthropomorphizes the truth as Buddha, as the eternal original Buddha. Now, from the perspective of forms of Buddhism that use more abstract, analytical, or philosophical language, what chapter 16 expresses is that all phenomena are actually intrinsically pure as expressions of the truth. Some types of Buddhism explain that all things are true because they arise through dependent origination, which we can think of as causation, the 12 causes and conditions. Since all things manifest in all situations and occurrences happen according to causation, if we see the law of causation when we look at things, we can see the truth in all things. Even sufferings and mistaken ideas, as well as bad actions, all happen through the workings of causation. For this reason, even suffering and impure things are permeated by the truth. In this sense, all phenomena are equal and is one. All things are thus or such in Buddhist language, ultimate reality. And when we contemplate things, both good and bad, both beneficial and unskillful, we discover the truth by doing so, and we are led to liberation. And in fact, it is more often than not that our unpleasant experiences are suffering, which pushes us to seek liberation by discovering the truth. One common phrase in Buddhism that expresses the notion that all things are truth is the statement, all dharmas are Buddha dharma. And in Japanese, you see the Japanese are issai no ho mina kore buppo nari. Now, this is a famous statement from Master Tiantai, who was one of the founders of Lotus Sutra Buddhism in China. But we can think of what he's saying is, you know, in other words, all things are Buddha dharma. We can think of this as a way of saying that all things are Buddha nature. Now, other types of Buddhism might talk about universal truth in terms of emptiness, and from the standpoint of emptiness, non-duality of all things. Now, this is really tough language. Non-duality might be, let me give you an example. Normally in our waking consciousness, we objectify things. So if I'm sitting here and I'm looking at a mountain, I see the mountain as something outside myself, something distinct and separate from myself that stands against myself. But from the standpoint of non-duality, the mountain is not different from me. I am the mountain, and the mountain is me. And that's a kind of mystical experience that a lot of people have in meditation. And there are also ways of understanding non-duality to also be the unity, while the unity of all things, at the same time, things are still actually distinct. So the mountain is me, I am the mountain, but yet I am still me and the mountain is still the mountain. A lot of that, you can see some of that kind of discourse in, for example, some of the writings of the monk Dogen. And a lot of that, that kind of talk you'll see also in Tibetan Buddhism, especially non-dual types of Tibetan Buddhist practice, like Dzogchen and things like that. So if we want to sort of get philosophical about the kind of things that the Lotus Sutra is expressing, it can get very, very, very difficult. Terms like these Buddhist doctrinal terms like suchness or thusness, shinyo in Japanese, tatata in Sanskrit, they're difficult doctrinal terms, and certainly not normal English, and definitely not even normal Japanese and Japanese either. Try as we may, it is hard to see sufferings and impure things as truth, that we investigate. If we investigate, we'll attain an awakening. It's really hard to accept that our suffering and the troubles in life can actually be beneficial to us. I mean, we naturally reject that. Even if we say it to ourselves, 5 minutes later, we'll rebel against that type of truth. It's hard to look upon the universe and see it as a compassionate thing. It's really hard. And this is the kind of question that, for example, people have struggled with throughout the 20th century, especially in the aftermath of the world wars and the Holocaust. It's really hard to believe, to truly believe, that the universe and everything in it is Buddha Dharma. You know, this is really hard to have faith in. I mean, let's be honest, right? I mean, we can talk about it, but it's easier said than done. However, the second half of the Lotus Sutra relates all of this through the persona of the eternal original Buddha. Now, this is indeed going one step beyond animating and actually anthropomorphizing universal truth. So if in the first half of the sutra, universal truth is the great life force that gives us the gift of life and sustains us, the message of chapter 16 is that we can understand the universal truth as the eternal Buddha who gives us the gift of life and sustains us. Now, here is where many people become confused, because they come to the Dharma with assumptions about what is Buddhist in character, as I discussed before. But as I discussed at length in my Dharma World article in considerable detail, this notion of, for example, the universe as the Buddha, the whole cosmos reaching out to you, or this idea of what people call the cosmic Buddha, personifying or anthropomorphizing universal truth as a cosmic Buddha whose body extends throughout the universe and works through all phenomena to teach and transform living beings. This idea is actually fairly common in Mahayana Buddhism, even though it's not a prominent feature of the new Buddhism of the Americas and Europe. Now, here we have a couple of examples of this. We have here, this is a statue, a 6th century Chinese statue of Vairochana, the cosmic Buddha. And you can see basically the six realms of transmigration within the body of the Buddha. Now, those of you who have done a lot of studying of the Lotus Sutra, Arcade teachings, or Tentai, Tendai, or Nichiren Shu teachings, you know that you have the 10 realms and the 9 realms are the sort of realms of existence. The 10th realm, the Buddha realm, is the sort of whole, the totality of all the realms. And this is basically what the statue is representing. Over here, on the right-hand side, we have, this is a tantric view of this. You have the Buddha Mahavairochana in the Tushita heaven. And on top of Mount Meru, the central mountain in Buddhist cosmology, and you have sort of the rest of the universe all around him. So this idea of cosmic Buddhas, or you know, we see this in the Huayan Sutra or the Avamtamsaka Sutra. Zen Buddhist temples on the continent in China and in Korea often enshrine Vairochana, this cosmic Buddha. We have in Tibetan Buddhism, we have different types of, we have, for example, in something called an Adi Buddha or an original Buddha, essentially, a primal Buddha. This idea of the sort of the cosmos as the, you know, as the Buddha in, you know, by personifying ultimate truth, anthropomorphizing it, is all over the place in Buddhism. And it's just that most of us haven't encountered it before. So here's a close-up of the statue on the bottom. And I have a quote here. If you're familiar with the closing sutra of the Threefold Lotus Sutra, there's a passage that says Shakyamuni Buddha is called Vairochana, present in all places. And this is one of the parts of the Threefold Lotus Sutra that gives you this sort of vision of the ultimate truth as a cosmic Buddha, as a Buddha sort of reaching out to you through all phenomena, and everything in the world as being part of Buddha, as being Buddha Dharma or part of Buddha. And you can see in the statue here, this is the bottom of the statue, and you see here, you see the realms of hells. So here are people in burning cauldrons and all those kind of very unpleasant suffering experiences. Now here is a very nice video presentation of that statue in 3D. Now this comes from the Smithsonian Institution, the Sackler Gallery in Washington, D.C. So if you're lucky and you go to Washington, D.C., you might be able to see this statue with your own eyes. If I remember correctly, it's one of their most famous pieces, so it's very often on display. And this is sort of really wonderful work here. This is some of the close up. So like I said, this according to the Sackler, they've dated this statue between 550 and 600 CE. And here we see sort of the realms of Buddhas and also gods, the palaces of gods. And let's see, maybe we go down further. Okay, we're going down. We're heading towards the human realms. And let's see, at the feet, so there were the hells right there. Here we go. Here's the feet of the statue. And here are the hells. And so it's very, very clear that, you know, in China in, you know, 550 AD, people are making statues to represent this idea of the entire universe as reaching out to and being part of encompassing the Buddha, the cosmic Buddha, the ultimate truth that permeates the universe as one great Buddha body. So there's another reason that I consider Risho Kosakai's way of talking about the eternal original Buddha to be, I consider essentially the easiest way to maybe to make to understand RK's language and explain it in maybe a way that people can understand is to think of it, to think of the ways that Risho Kosakai teaches people to perceive or think about or interact with ultimate truth and the eternal original Buddha is to take it as an extremely powerful contemplation, a type of Buddha mindfulness. It's a very effective way, I think, of being mindful of truth as Buddha, of seeing all things and everything that happens as truth to be realized, and not allowing anything in our lives that happens to us to be without meaning and to be in vain. As a contemplation, we can say it's a kind of skillful meaning. But I think it's a very direct path for realizing universal truth that I just explained before in very philosophical terms. I think Risho Kosakai's language uses our own human emotions. You know, the human emotions, there are mundane truths of our daily lives. It uses them to realize ultimate truth. So Risho Kosakai's language doesn't negate ordinary human emotions and consciousness. Instead, it makes skillful use of them. And I'm sure that those of you who are Risho Kosakai members, you chant chapter 16, the verses from chapter 16 every day, and they're in your Kyoten. And there's a section of the Kyoten that says to look up to the Buddha with thirsting hearts, right, in chapter 16. Thirst. The Sanskrit behind that word is actually Trishna. Now, Trishna is this word that in Buddhism often means desire, craving. It's often a negative term. It's that word that you see in the 12 causes and conditions. And here it is describing, being used to describe faith in the Buddha. It's kind of shocking when you see, you know, the sort of language sort of behind the English. And I think that what this is telling us is that, you know, the Lotus Sutra, as Jean Mies always said, was a world-affirming, life-affirming teaching. And the Lotus Sutra itself is taking human emotions, taking our ordinary experience, and it's using it as a vehicle to attain enlightenment, to attain awakening. It's not requiring us to reject our human emotions. We don't have to become Mr. Spock to gain an awakening, but we can use our emotions as a vehicle to get to truth. It's a very powerful, skillful means because we have our emotions. They're there all the time. We are who we are. And instead of trying to force us to be something different, this kind of metaphorical language about the Buddha and envisioning the Buddha and taking refuge in the Buddha and ultimate truth essentially makes use of who we already are. So that to see the eternal original Buddha as our true parent. Now, you know, one of the prime metaphors of the sutra, the Lotus Sutra is this idea that the Buddha is our parent or our father, or if you want to think of it as our mother. To see this, the original Buddha as our true parent, who is always together with us, reaching out to us and speaking to us through everything we encounter, I think encourages us to see everything as true and pure and provides us with opportunities for awakening. To constantly remind ourselves that we are given the gift of life and sustained by the eternal original Buddha brings us and encourages us to have faith in everything and have gratitude for everything. I think it leads us to see everything as bright and shining, as wonderful and pure, as Shakyamuni Buddha saw it on the morning of his awakening. Now, if you go back and you read stories about Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening, on the morning of his awakening, you know, everything in the world was glowing and luminous. Luminosity is sort of this word that's used to describe the way Shakyamuni Buddha saw the world. And I think that these powerful sort of metaphorical meditations, that essentially way of looking at the world that Isho Kosekai introduces to people, really move us in that direction and can give us a glimpse of the world as luminous and shining and pure and bright. Now, Foundry Nirvana in his writings often says that true liberation is the conviction that the Buddha is always together with us. To keep this in your mind and to see the world from this standpoint is essentially, it's in the more analytical language of Master Tiantai, all dharmas are Buddha dharma. The phrases that R.K. founder Niwano taught, think of them as meditations, as forms of mindfulness of the Buddha. And I think, you know, if you regard them this way, I think if any of you who have questioned this kind of language, I think you can get past that and maybe learn to appreciate the R.K. discourse in a new way. You know, this idea of always being together with the Buddha or being sustained by the Buddha and given the gift of life as a form of being mindful of the Buddha. And it's not something that's really difficult to do in the sense that you can do it in your everyday life. It doesn't require a lot of steps. Anyone can use the Isho Kosekai's language to be mindful of the Buddha. It doesn't require any special training. All it requires is diligence. Okay, another thing I'd like to touch upon too is when we talk about, you know, anthropomorphizing the Buddha, a prominent aspect of East Asian Buddhism and the Lotus Sutra tradition, including the Isho Kosekai, is acknowledgement and remorse, sometimes translated as repentance in Japanese sangye. Now, consider this. How would you do sangye? Oh, let me go back. In Nisho Kosekai, there are essentially two types of acknowledgement and remorse. There's one in front of our fellow practitioners. For example, in Hosa, to talk about maybe something that we regret, to be introspective in front of our fellow practitioner, our good spiritual friend. But there's another type of acknowledgement and remorse that's done in front of the Buddha, with regard to the Buddha or toward the Buddha. And think about this. If we were trying to do acknowledgement and remorse toward universal truth, how would we do that? Usually, when we want to confess or to open up, we need another person. And that's generally, not all people in all cases, but generally we need a witness. For example, those of you who know anything about the Catholic tradition, there's the tradition of confession. Now, some people might be critical and say, well, why the heck do you have to confess to a human being? Why not just God? But there's something about having a witness. There's something about sharing our feelings with another person that allows that other person to become a mirror, and then our feelings come back to us. They're reflected back to us, and we can really understand ourselves and what we feel. We need to objectify our emotions and our feelings. Or you've heard the fact that everyone has a desire to confess. You know, even criminals. You know, criminals might leave unknowingly or leave evidence behind that gets them caught. Or eventually, people want to confess. People have a desire to share things that are secrets, and they can't keep their mouth shut, right? So acknowledgement remorse really needs, it's a relationship again, and it needs a persona, a person on the other side. And so acknowledgement remorse would be really hard to do if we did not step into that perception of perceiving ultimate truth as the Buddha, of anthropomorphizing essentially truth. And here you see in this little photograph, there's a boy. He's probably taking the ordination, which requires practicing acknowledgement and remorse as one of the components of the ordination ceremony. And you can see there's a directionality to it. He's facing the Buddha, and he has in his palms pressed together, he's got lotus flowers. And this is something you see across Asia when people do. There are ceremonies of acknowledgement and remorse, and this is one of the ritual actions you see, but it's very directed. There's a directionality. There's an intentionality to it. Our ideas and our thoughts, they have to have content and directionality. And this idea of the eternal original Buddha, you know, anthropomorphizing truth, stepping into that mindset allows us, essentially facilitates acknowledgement and remorse. And let me show you an example from another type of Buddhism that I think will show that what RK's discourse is not that different or not that rare in Mahayana Buddhism. So let me make a comparison with other types of Buddhist contemplation that do essentially in some ways or resonate with Vishoko Sekai language. There's a type of Buddhism commonly known as Tantra. Sometimes it's called mantra, or in English it might be translated as esoteric Buddhism. Now, for those of you who are Japanese speakers, I'm talking about Mikyo. And Mikyo in Japanese Buddhism is primarily found in the Tendai and the Shingon denominations of Buddhism. Now, Mikyo or esoteric Buddhism or these type of practices are found in Nepali Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, Mongolian Buddhism, as well as Japanese Buddhism. And it's still they're still found sometimes in Chinese Buddhism as well, but it's not as prominent. Now, esoteric Buddhism makes use of symbolic gestures called mudras or seals, as well as mantra chanting, combined with visualizing the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in your mind. Now, in Tantra or esoteric Buddhism, practitioners will visualize a Buddha in front of them. And sometimes they might even visualizing themselves becoming one with that Buddha, a sort of a yoga, a oneness. So let me describe one of the practices that's done in Japanese Buddhism that I'm familiar with. And this is a practice that Tendai or Shingon monks will do before they, for example, chant the sutra. Before the practitioner chants, they sit down, they form a mudra, and they utter a mantra that invokes first the Buddhas. And they visualize the Buddhas appearing around them. So here we have the practitioner. He utters a mantra and then visualizes the Buddhas around him. Then he utters another mantra and another mudra to invoke or to call in the presence of the Bodhisattvas, like the regarder of the sounds of the world. And then finally, the practitioner invokes or calls a type of bodhisattva that we can call vajra-holding bodhisattvas. They're kind of angry-looking guys. The most common in Japanese Buddhism is, over here you see this small little drawing of what's called the Fudomyoho, or the Achalanatta Vijayaraja in Sanskrit. So essentially what the practitioner is doing is this anthropomorphizing skillful means of bringing the Buddhas down around them in three layers: the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the Vajra-holding Bodhisattvas. Now, what this is, essentially, it's a powerful, skillful means to attain the conviction or remind yourself that the Buddha is always with you, guiding you, and protecting you. And I think you can see the parallels with Disho Kosekai teachings about the original Buddha. Disho Kosekai's methods share much with other types of Buddhism. And what I'm getting at here is that RK's language and methods are quite Buddhist, very skillful, and based on, I think, on a deep knowledge of the workings of the human mind. Now, in the case of tantric practices or esoteric Buddhist practices, they require initiations that can be quite harsh. If you talk to any friends that practice Tibetan Buddhism, maybe they've done 10,000 prostrations so that they could get a transmission of these type of practices. These practices also require much instruction, and they can be very difficult to learn because there's a ceremonial or a ritual side to them. Thus, in truth, tantric practices are really not open to everyone. They're kind of restricted. Now, in contrast, Disho Kosekai's methods are open to everyone and easily done. You can practice Disho Kosekai's ways of looking at the Buddha in every moment of life. In every interaction experience, you can tell yourself, the Buddha is always together with me. Or, I am given the gift of life and sustained by the Buddha. The Buddha is the great life of the universe. All my experiences are the arrangements of the Buddha. My experiences are messages from the Buddha. Nothing that happens to me is in vain. By keeping these words in our minds, we can deepen our faith in the Dharma. When held in our minds, these words can change our thinking and transform our experience of reality. Using these powerful, skillful means that animate the universal truth and anthropomorphize the Buddha, we use our natural way of thinking about and interacting with things in order to attain deeper faith. And more directly and quickly perceive, I think, the ultimate reality of all things. So I hope this explanation allows you to understand and feel more comfortable with the eternal original Buddha and the way that Disho Kosekai speaks about universal truth and the Buddha with phrases like life of the universe or the notion that we are given the gift of life and sustained by the Buddha. And I hope thinking of or accepting these practices as types of contemplation or Buddha mindfulness, it's Sanskrit, Buddha Nismirti, thinking about them in these ways, I hope it will maybe give you a tool to explain these Disho Kosekai practices to other people who might be confused by them the first time they hear the Disho Kosekai language. So to summarize, yes, the Lotus Sutra and Nisho Kosekai's language does indeed animate and anthropomorphize universal truth. But this is not a claim that the Buddhas are something like the creator god of monotheistic traditions, and nor is it something that is un-Buddhist. Animating and anthropomorphizing is how our minds tend to perceive things. It facilitates our understanding. And I think it's a valid way of making sense of things and should not be seen as primitive or childish. Using these kinds of metaphorical ways of thinking can, in fact, be an effective cognitive strategy. Animating and anthropomorphizing also allows us to deepen our faith and ability to take refuge wholeheartedly. Now, keeping in mind the notion that we are given the gift of life and sustained by the Buddha, and seeing the cosmos as a compassionate harmony by being mindful of the universal truth as the great life of the universe, can be considered powerful and effective contemplations. skillful forms of meditation that can be performed in every minute of our daily lives. So for this reason, they are powerfully transformative and effective practices for attaining awakening. We should indeed understand the Dharma in rational and logical analytical terms. I think that's a must. To do so is entering the teaching through understanding. But we also need to join our understanding to faith to achieve what the Lotus Sutra talks about as faith and understanding, or in Japanese, shinge, in Sanskrit, arimukti. The ways of envisioning the universal truth and the eternal original Buddha that the Shoko Sekai teaches, I think, are effective strategies for developing such faith. And as the Lotus Sutra explains, attaining faith and understanding, even minimally, a moment of faith and understanding brings innumerable benefits. Now, will using Nisshoko Sekai's language make us think that the Buddha, or make us mistakenly think that the Buddha is a monotheistic creator god or something like Brahma in Hinduism? No, I don't think so. As long as we do study the Dharma and we have that understanding, I don't think we'll be confused in those ways. As I showed before, we can step in and out of different modes of perception. We can move between a more analytical, philosophical grasp of the Dharma and the Buddha and a more personified, animated, and anthropomorphized perception. Like the drawing here, again, we can see this drawing sometimes as a rabbit and sometimes as a duck of our own choosing. If you say to yourself, this is a duck, you will see a duck. If you say to yourself, now I want to look at this as a rabbit, you will see a rabbit. If you try that kind of experiment with yourself, you'll see that that's actually how your perception tends to work. So we can shift modes of perception in interaction with the Buddha Dharma freely as necessary. We don't have to fall into the fallacy that only one perspective or explanation of something is true. Now, if you take a look at the little GIF I have here, or pic I have here, and I would like to thank Reverend Chris Ladisaw of the Oklahoma Dharma Center for this. She sent this to me. Both of the shadows reflect the reality of that cylinder. Both are true because the cylinder itself is truth. So there can be multiple perspectives that from a particular perspective or for a particular reason or goal are true. So each perspective is a skillful means that has its particular purpose. Now, contemplation based on metaphorical language that animates and personifies universal truth is a skillful means that can speedily and deeply develop our faith and help us see the world through the eyes of the Buddha. And as a skillful means that leads to universal truth, it is true. Skillful means lead to awakening. They are connected to awakening. And for this reason, skillful means are true and necessary. Now, I often use the analogy of a bridge. And this metaphor doesn't work for all ways we can think about the relationship between delusion and awakening. But we have skillful means here on the bridge, right? And skillful means is both in, it's attached to awakening. It's on the side of awakening. And it's on the side of delusion at the same time. It traverses both. And the skillful means in that it connects to awakening essentially is inseparable from universal truth. The two are inseparable. And this is what makes skillful means true. Now, you know, in chapter two of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha makes the statement, you know, I haven't yet taught you the ultimate truth. In 40 years of teaching. But then the Buddha shifts to praising how wonderful skillful means are. And Shariputra is at first confused. Because in the end, skillful, universal truth is expressed through skillful means. It's expressed through a medium. Just like in our minds, when we have an emotion, if we love somebody, for example, they don't know unless we express it through a medium. The medium can be a smile. The medium can be words. The medium can be a gift. The medium can be a touch. But unless we use the medium, we cannot make our emotions present in the world. That's what skillful means to us. It makes universal truth present to us. So the kind of language that Nisho Kusakai uses is a skillful means that I think leads to awakening. It's connected to awakening, and thus it's true, and I think for many people necessary. So thank you for listening. And I'm looking forward to any questions or discussions we can have. And I'd also like to thank Emmy at Arkina for facilitating this talk. She always does such a wonderful job. And with that, I'm going to end sharing my screen and hand it back over to Emmy.
Thank you very much, Dr. Scarangelo. This concludes the Lotus Sutra lecture titled, What is the Original Buddha? Discovering a Compassionate and Meaningful Universe Through the Focus of Devotion. Arkina offers classes on Buddhism, information on meditation, holds online gatherings, and practices chanting. Please visit our website at www.arkina.org for information on upcoming events.